Good morning. It's Friday. It's the 62nd edition of the Zocchi Report, real and unscripted. And that's what it is. It's real and unscripted. No rehearsals and no all surprises. I'm here with my son, Jeremy, as I always am. And how are you doing this week?
Pretty good. How about you?
I'm doing okay. Busy week. Very busy.
Very busy.
So I start, unless you want to.
Well, why don't you start? And then if I want to take it down another avenue, we'll see.
All right. Okay. Well, the President of the United States had his first official news conference yesterday. And of course, that's news, both the fact that it took 58 days, that's kind of a record, but also because he had a lot to say. And so let's talk about his news conference. And I'll just start with commentary. For those who were expecting the president to look and act old, to be out of it, to not perform well, to go off script, I thought we saw a president who's very much in command of himself, certainly prepared with facts and figures, may have answered a few questions on immigration at exceptional length, but all fact-filled and, certainly didn't diverge from the topic. But essentially, I think what we saw was a president who was in command. This guy knows what he's talking about, and he's got a very clear agenda. And that was the look, the image. In terms of the content, I think the president, the very beginning, addressed the issue of COVID and the economy, talked about how within 58 days of his presidency now, the Relief and Recovery Act has been passed, that Americans will see some considerable money, that the economy is starting its path to turning around, that while he had promised 100 million vaccinations by the first 100 days, he had already achieved that 100 million vaccinations and now was saying 200 million vaccinations by the first 100 days. And so with that said, you know, he was going to define the terms of his accomplishments. And then he went on, of course, to talk about immigration. We can talk about those things as you and I discuss. But I'll just end by saying, at the beginning of the week, I got an email from Gilles Saint-Gilles from Paris, who writes for L'Opinion. And Gilles wondered, he said, what's the difference between Joe Biden and Barack Obama? And I said, the biggest difference, obviously, aside from their age and level of experience, is that Obama was elected because of a vision, because of hope, because of youth, because of the youth vote. There's a lot of excitement. But there was no crisis when he entered the White House. Biden, I think, begs comparisons to FDR and to LBJ, both of whom launched massive spending programs and a huge domestic employment agenda because they were responding to essentially do or die agendas. Obviously, with FDR, the peak of the Depression, and with Lyndon Johnson, the race war that the civil rights movement had evolved into. Biden obviously facing the impact of the fourth industrial revolution, the dislocation that technology brings, the change in America's status and role in the world, and then obviously the worst pandemic that we've seen in 100 years. I think that Biden is modeling himself after Roosevelt and to a large degree the domestic policies of Lyndon Johnson. And we'll see how that works for him.
Yeah. So, I mean, to be fair, and this is a tradition of mine going back to when I started paying attention to current events, which was around the beginning of George W. Bush's presidency. I typically don't watch the press conferences and State of the Union addresses. I do, you know, I will see clips, but I'm mindful of the fact that clips don't capture the whole thing. So I'm in a position where I, you know, you clearly watched it and followed it from start to beginning. So I can't really say too much, but it's no hidden truth to our regular listeners that I'm counterfactual and I tend to be contrarian. I wouldn't say tend, I am contrarian. And that's not because I take pleasure in being different. I've always been that way. I mean, even going back to grade school, I've just always been on a different path, the rhythm to my own drum. And I don't see that changing, but I had a very unique experience this week, and I'm going to try and tie this back all together. I was on a guest on a panel in Insights Festival on sampling and diversity, and we had people who, you know, this is obviously in the field of market research and survey research, public opinion polling, and so you had the people behind the scenes who gather the samples, and then you have the people like us who work with the sample, field it, and then do the analysis. And my colleagues were really smart. We had a woman from high up at BET, Black Entertainment Television. We had a very bright, intelligent academic PhD sociologist and people who work in the field. And so I tended to go last in the discussions, maybe because of my last name, alphabetical order, but it was like, wow, how do I add to the discussion with such smart people? And so I found a way to elevate the discussion. And I want to just point out to our listeners, that's what I want us to do. We're in this environment where it's becoming very uncomfortable. I love to talk politics, but it's becoming very uncomfortable because as soon as you disagree and as soon as you counterfact or as soon as you're contrarian, you are igniting the fire, and maybe in terms of rage and in terms of passion on the other side. And I just don't want to go down that road. So I asked the question, how can we elevate this discussion beyond good, bad, beyond left, right, and try and achieve objectivity and just do something entirely different? What can we say about this press conference that's beyond what most people are used to? Good versus bad, positive, negative. Can we achieve objectivity?
Yeah, you just heard it in the first 5 minutes of our conversation. I honestly thought that the president did well. Remember, there were a set of expectations for him, and he blew those expectations away by simply being in command of, I say it again, of the position, of knowing what he was talking about, being comfortable in his shoes. In fact, the only risk that I saw as I watched him was that he raised the bar very high. And can he continue to keep the bar at that level? But certainly anybody, I think, today who might suggest that, he ignored Fox News on purpose, or that he there were only 30 reporters there because of COVID, or that he dodged questions or got softball questions from the press, I think that's where partisanship comes in. I think, frankly, what I was looking for, and as you know, I always tried to be very fair with Donald Trump and with Obama before him in my assessments. I mean, how would it play in the polls? And I think that first of all, the president has a good polling numbers. He's at about 54-55% in terms of his average. More importantly, though, he's getting, very high marks on handling of COVID, on handling of the economy, in terms of support for the $1.9 trillion package. And I don't think that he did anything yesterday to hurt himself.
So where were the, I mean, where could there have been fair criticisms?
Well, you know, to be totally objective, I mean, this is a man who at one time probably could have sank three footers from outside the perimeter, probably can't make a reach anymore. This is an older Joe Biden, and let's face it, he's redefining
policy-wise.
What could have been fair policy-wise?
No, critical not of policy. Image, but of content.
All right, well, he did say, I can't see a scenario under which U.S. troops are still in Afghanistan by the end of this year. I thought he hedged on that question, but I thought he could have hedged even more. That's a very volatile situation. Mm-hmm. You know, Americans, both the people and the politicians, for the most part, don't want us in Afghanistan anymore. But there are conditions on the ground. There are arrangements with our allies. There is the specter of the Taliban. To commit to zero presence of American troops, I thought may have been a little risky. You and I have talked about foreign policy. Interestingly, the issue of his statements on Vladimir Putin were not raised during the press conference. There's only so much you can do, you know, in a press conference in 1 hour, and there's no shortage of crises. But, you know, the absence of the discussion of our relationship with Russia, I think was probably a reasonable criticism, but it wasn't raised.
Here's where objectivity comes into play, and that's the long view of history. I see a tendency in most students of American students of history to look at history just from the lens of the last century, the 20th century. Mm-hmm. I mean, even they get trapped in the last 500 years, the modern era, which is a blip. I mean, I was reading something yesterday. Think about this. Herodotus, you know, one of the fathers of history, when he would read or analyze or look at the remnants of the Hittites, of the Babylonians, and of the Sumerians, that was the ancient world to him. Think about that. So we think of the ancient world, we think of Greece and Rome, but there's an ancient, ancient, ancient world. And so that's why the further you go back in history, you really transcend left versus right. So here's the point on foreign policy. It is a fact that anyone who has invaded Afghanistan mm-hmm. has fallen. It is nicknamed the graveyard of empires. That was true of Alexander the Great. That was true of the British. That was true of the Soviets. There's other cases as well. Why are we going to be an exception to that? I think that, you know, is basically a law. You were talking about one of the most rugged terrains in the world. You're talking about a people, the Parthians. That's who they were. They go back. I mean, they're the brethren of the Persians. They share a lineage with the ancient Persians. These people know their land. They've been there for millennia. They know it better than anybody else. It's some of the toughest terrain, and as a result, they are possibly the toughest people, and it has buried every empire. That is precisely, aside for humanitarian reasons of exacerbating the situation, and also because of our history in Afghanistan, you know, look, it's no secret the CIA bankrolled Osama bin Laden back in the 70s to fight the Soviets. And so we're not very well liked there. We really have no business there other than strategic, you know, positioning of. And look, I've heard this from former military men, too. natural resources. Afghanistan and the surrounding area are very rich in rare earth minerals. And so the perception is if we don't get that, the Chinese or the Russians will get that. But at the cost of what? Burying, you know, the United States budget-wise, morale-wise, and in terms of our reputation abroad, we need to get the heck out. And if a president can't understand that, they're just following suit. You know, ask Alexander the Great.
Well, as you know, in a real world, there are other considerations. I think that the will to leave Afghanistan is very strong. I don't want a presence there either. The flip side of that are agreements that have already been made. There's concern, you know, it's a given that the Taliban's positioning has been strengthened, and that the war between the Northern Alliance and its allies and the Taliban continues. The Taliban is in the ascendancy. What's that mean for the role of women? You know, yes, we can say it's their battle, and even go stronger than that. It's not only their battle, but we're not helping to a great degree by being there. By the same token, in response to a very simple question, will we be totally out of there by the end of the year? I think it's just a tough prediction to make. But I also don't think that it was a game changer, because you just asked me what are some things where I could be critical, and that was one of them. I don't think you should have said that.
Well, I was just adding to my critical point of view. Mm-hmm. My analysis of what I can talk about. But I will say this, and we can move on to immigration. I don't personally believe that we're in there, or that the intelligence community is in there for humanitarian reasons. If they were, they never would have funded the Mujahideen in the beginning. They never would have bankrolled Osama bin Laden. I mean, those are awful, awful people. And what's The Kite Runner? Just read that novel. I know you read it. You told me about the book. I read the book, but this is to our audience. If you haven't read the book, read The Kite Runner, and that's who we're talking about. Those are the people that were propped up and bankrolled by the intelligence community early on. So, I mean, they should have known better. But, you know, moving on to the border, this is, you know, I rarely discuss the border, because this is, I think, one of the most charged topics, because it's so contentious. And if you say the wrong thing, you know, if you're on the left and you say the wrong thing, you're a communist who wants open borders, who wants the nation overrun by people who don't share our values. If you're for strength and security, you're a xenophobic racist. It's like, wow. I mean, why even get involved in that debate? So the only angle that I can say come in at is I was intrigued by a Reuters article that came out a couple of weeks ago that basically said the Mexican president is very critical of Joe Biden and says, and from his perspective, believes that Joe Biden is exacerbated a crisis at the border and has incentivized cartels. And then in the article, again, Reuters, an anonymous Mexican official, he did not want his name to be leaked, echoed that effect and basically said, look, the current policy right now is just emboldening traffickers, drug cartels. And so I bring this up because of, you know, the banner of objectivity. It's interesting, while we debate this internally within our borders, what does the rest of the world think? You know, I would think the Mexican officials are perhaps some of the biggest stakeholders in this. What's their perception? And so that's just an inkling of, I'm sure there's diverse opinion, but some higher up people, including the president of Mexico, have some very tough criticisms of Joe Biden.
Yeah, Manuel Lopez Obrador is well known as a left-wing demagogue. I'm not even sure how left-wing he is anymore, but he's clearly a demagogue. And they have as a policy that once the folks that he's pushing out of Mexico cross the border, he doesn't want them back in, not letting them back in. I mean, the key issue here is, what does the United States do with people who are rushing to the border? Do we send them back to situations where they really can't go back? You know, in Guatemala, in Honduras, elsewhere in Central America, they fear for their lives and their economic well-being. You know, when they get to the border, you know, there is this sense that, oh, it's parents taking advantage of an empathic president, a good guy, Joe, unlike Donald Trump, and, you know, pushing the kids over into the United States so that it'll be America's problem. The reality is the parents don't want to part with their children, number one. It's they want a future for their children, and so there's hope. And number two, I think, as the president pointed out yesterday, and is not a new point at all, the push at the border generally increases every year, including under Trump, who had draconian policies towards children and families. It increases every winter, fall and winter, simply because the desert that they cross through, the sun and the intense heat is not as bad as if they try to come, you know, in June, July, or August. And so I thought the president made clear that this is something that has continued under Obama and under Trump. The only time that the push at the border dissipated was during the last economic crisis. In 2008, 2009, there wasn't a reason to come to the United States. But what do you do once they do come in? Do you send them back to countries that don't want them back? Do you provide sustenance for them? Do you house them in barracks under bad conditions? Do you allow families to be separated? These are difficult questions, not only because they're difficult to answer in and of themselves, but because there's no disagreement. As you pointed out, the two sides are intractable.
Yeah. And look, from a humanitarian perspective, people who are in need and are just trying to come to a place where they can better their life, there's nothing controversial about that. To me, what's lost in the discussion is look, let's face the reality of human trafficking. This is the 800-pound gorilla in the room that I don't know why this really is the number one topic of the 21st century. It's really the number one topic of human history. I mean, the most lucrative business in the history of civilization has been slavery, which includes human trafficking of workers, of sex workers, of all kinds. You know, whether you call it slavery or trafficking, it's all the same thing. And just as it was in the ancient world, even today, probably definitely more so today, it's arguably one of the most profitable businesses. But That's where I think the discussion is lost is how do you determine who's being pushed in there through trafficking? I don't know. I'm not security. I'm not Department of Homeland Security. I'm not intelligence. But let's not shy away from that real discussion. To me, that's among the major humanitarian issue in the issue of immigration. And the reason I brought up that Reuters article is because the anonymous official basically alluded to that, that that's a huge issue within the issue of immigration. And well, I have one other thing, and but I'll wait because I said a lot.
No, go ahead. No, continue.
Well, I mean, it's a slightly different topic. So it's still within immigration, but it's moving the conversation. I think we need to address what I just said.
I mean, I think we are well aware of the problem of human trafficking. There are lots of organizations globally, as well as in this region, that are trying to deal with it. It's like organized crime. It is organized crime.
Yeah.
Its intersection with legitimate businesses is troubling. Its intersection with government authorities is troubling. The demand, like drugs, is very high, whether it's for sex work or for cheap labor. All of this suggests that it is, as you point out, a very huge problem. Is it being discussed? Oh, I believe it is being discussed. I also believe that there just isn't an easy solution to it, yeah. Unfortunately. But I don't think it's because there's a lack of conversation about it.
Well, we're on the list of an organization that deals with it. I just got an email the other day about it. The UN talks about it, but my frustration is it really should. I mean, when I say the mainstream media, I mean the big outlets, all the way from Fox to CNN, not just cable, but also their websites, but as well as the major newspapers, from the Washington Post and Times all the way to the New York Times. And I know they talk about it, but I feel like it's not brought up front and center into the immigration debate, more precisely what's going on at the border. But anyway, one of the clips I caught at the press conference, and I couldn't tell who the woman was. She looked, you know, everybody were in masks, but she looked like she could have been one of the major correspondents at NBC. Who is the woman who did an excellent job at the presidential debate?
Oh, Kristen Welker, White House correspondent.
Was she there?
Yeah, she asked about eight questions. Yeah,
and was she the one who raised the question as to why aren't they allowing the journalists to go to the centers where the children?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That was one of the pieces that I caught in a clip. There were a couple others, but I thought that was a good question. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't really understand what Joe Biden's rationalization was.
I think what he wanted to do, I'm not defending it or criticizing it. I think his response was, we just got here. It's 58 days. I've just appointed the vice president to be in charge of the situation down there. Let us get a chance to go down there and see it for ourselves and to come up with and talk to folks, come up with some recommendations. And whether that's legitimate or not, transparency is a very good thing, but sometimes when transparency intersects with policy, it can cause confusion. You know, it can cause disarray. And so, I mean, that's the only thing I can say about it. But it does appear there's plenty of reporting going on. So it's not as if we don't know what's going on down there, or that there hasn't been video as well.
I just find it interesting that in her question, she was basically saying journalists aren't really allowed in there. I don't know what I don't. Was she grandstanding? Was she?
Oh, I don't think so. She's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, she's a very good news person.
So I guess just in terms of a timeline, because, you know, we got to hold them to that. Well, we'll revisit that in a couple months if that's still the case. I would say that would be a major issue if that still yes. continues.
And it is. And I think we'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Okay. Take care.